Welcome to the Conference on World Affairs. It is 3 p.m. on this beautiful snowy day in Boulder, and we are about to start panel 2501, which is Social Media 20 Years Later. I'm your moderator, Casey Fiesler, and I'm a professor here at University of Colorado in the Information Science Department, which is in a building right next to this one, conveniently, because of the snow. And I study social media policy and ethics. But you're not here to listen to me. You're here to listen to our fabulous panelists that we have. So here with me at the table, we have Ali Barta, who is the founder of Nuna Med, a startup that offers botanically-based solutions for common ailments. We also have Jason Breed, who, with over 20 years of experience in digital and social media, is the CEO of the Digital Futures Initiative. Next to him, we have William Hertling, who is a science fiction writer and a web strategist and programmer, and his techno-thriller novels cover issues like data ownership and privacy. And we also have Reza Ramazan, who is a professor of economics at St. Michael's College in Vermont and has his MA and PhD from right here at CU Boulder.
Go Buffs!
Go Buffs! So we're going to start out with each of our panelists taking about 5 minutes to tell you more about themselves and to talk about whatever they want related to this topic. So we're going to start with Ali.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for being here. So I'm Ali Barta, as Casey introduced me. And I have to say go Hoos on top of go Buffs because I got my MBA and Master's in Public Policy from UVA last year. Unfortunately, I wasn't there when they became basketball champs. But at the same time, it's not too far from Richmond, Virginia, where I live now. So since I think I'm the youngest person on this panel, I will do a little step back in time. I remember when we got our first computer growing up in California. Compaq. I think I was about 10 years old. My brother, who's closest to me in age, and I would play Oregon Trail. Then fast forward, I think I was probably 11 years old, and I had my first crush on Jack Arnold, and we would instant message on AOL when it was that whole you've got mail dial-up connection. I can still hear that sound. And I hear some murmurs over there. Yes. And so social media has changed a lot over my lifetime. And over the past 20 years, I personally have always been a late adopter. And so when I was in high school and MySpace came into being, I never had that. Then fast forward, I graduated from high school in 2007, at which point I said, oh my goodness, all these people are trying to find their roommates on Facebook. Maybe I need to get on that. And so I got on Facebook at that point. And then since then, personally, actually 5 years ago, why I'm standing is I broke my back. 5 years ago. And so I decided at that point, too, there was so much going on that I wasn't going to use social media anymore personally. And so I cut the ties with social media, no more Facebook, never on MySpace, no Instagram. But at the same time, it's been really interesting because then fast forward, and I was starting my company, Nuna Med, and you aren't legitimate if you aren't on social media, if you're a startup anymore. So I vividly remember going and talking with someone, and they said, well, how can I find you on Instagram? Now it's at Nuna_med, if one of you wants to add me. but I said, oh, I'm not on Instagram yet. And he said, oh, then you're not a real company. And so at that point, I said, my goodness, I need to get on there. And it's been a journey. It's a lot of time and a lot of work to try and have a small, tiny little brand get some awareness and generate an awareness with the masses, particularly for something that's kind of niche, like urinary tract infections that I personally struggle with, and that's the purpose of the first product. But ultimately, it's been one heck of a lesson because I think you go into it and you think, well, if I do an Instagram ad or if I run Google AdWords, I'm going to have all these people with the exact condition that I'm looking for flock to my company and flock to my website and want to buy my product, and it's going to be great, and that's the way to get things up and running in this modern age. But it hasn't been like that. I spent a good amount of money, and maybe I'm about to learn I haven't spent it appropriately, but at the same time, it's been a lot of testing and reiterating and figuring out if things work or if they don't. And I personally am always learning to try and figure out how to handle social media. And I lean a lot on college students and people who are a lot more knowledgeable than me in terms of the audience I'm hoping to attract. So that's where I am right now with social media, and we'll see what happens in the next 20 years, because my goodness, it's been a lot in the past 20.
Thank you. I will also mention briefly that as we hear from our panelists, as interesting questions start coming to mind for you, you can either use the app to send a question right up here to me via the magic of technology, or you can do it the analog way and flag down one of our helpers who are holding note cards, and then they will bring them to me. So feel free to think of questions at any time during this. Jason.
Me next. Good. All right, so before I start, I'm going to get a little post here, a little something for my post. So, all right, good. So, Jason Breed, and just a little background, because I think the intro was a little nefarious in like what I actually do, but I started in this space. Let's say back in 2012 was my, or sorry, 2000. I started in this space. In 2002 was probably the most meaningful project that I had ever worked on, even still to this day. I worked for a social media platform. Back in the day, and we built the system, the platform for the rebuilding efforts of the World Trade Center. So right after the attack, there was this big effort to bring together all the thoughts and opinions and ideas, and just be a point of connectedness to all the communities and frankly, all the world to come together on this one project. And so I was on that program there, and we did that for about 5 years. Did everything from collecting inputs to the actual selection of the Libeskind master plan design that was then moved forward into what it is today. Right. So that's kind of my background, and ever since I've been. And I guess in the leading edge, if you will, of social media and how that affects businesses. So social business. I led the Worldwide Growth Initiative for Accenture, which is a large consulting company, and led the growth initiative around social business for that. And then got hired into IBM, where I led the social business worldwide initiative, growth initiative for IBM there. And today, work in a platform around content and still in the space, but around privacy and consent and what do we do as a user with our data. And then 2 years ago, I started a nonprofit, there's been a big gap in. This world that we're growing up now in a digital world, and it was a nonprofit to kind of address that through children, and I have three kids, one at college, go Huskers, and one in college, one in sophomore in high school, and a sixth grader as well. So you know, for a time I had a elementary, middle, and high school. Children and so this is directly with that. And Digital Futures Initiative is the nonprofit that we started a couple of years ago to provide curriculum to help schools augment how to raise kids to be successful, accountable, responsible in a digital and social media and device driven age. And so 2 years now in our one and a half or almost two full school years in, where our curriculum is used in all 50 states. We're used in seven countries. We're teaching about 1 million kids a day right now with an addressable market. That sounds nice, but it's an addressable market of about 65 million kids in school right now. And all of these kids need to understand how to be productive in a digital world. And, you know, it's not... For me, I think that education is still a community, and we need to bring together the community professional and education and private sector to fulfill that community. So that's my passion is still in this social space and helping kids and parents raise digital natives as well.
Great. William?
Thanks. So I have a long history with online culture that dates back way beyond social media, as we were talking about a little bit before. So I was getting online in the mid-1980s and running a chat system out of my basement at a time where you had to be a serious geek in order to be able to get online and communicate with people. And what was amazing about that was what a transformational communication capacity that this was for people who might have been too shy or too inhibited to talk in person, that people could suddenly talk online. They could talk without being self-conscious about what they were talking about. They could talk about topics that would be too vulnerable maybe to bring up with their friends in person. And people were able to find their community. They could find a place where they could feel safe and talk to like-minded people. And this was really different than anything we had in real life. So it seemed very, very promising. In the 1990s, that sort of went global in the era of us dialing up into the internet. Now we're chatting not just with people who maybe were local to us, but people who were anywhere in the world. So even further, we could find our communities that and our subcultures that we wanted to connect with. In the 2000s, it really felt like the heyday of all of this stuff, all of the history of online community coming together in a way that was accessible for everybody. Now we could all be online, we could all participate in these kinds of global conversations. And I got involved in blogging and Twitter and LinkedIn, and I got involved in driving social media strategy at my company. So it just felt like the culmination of all of this stuff. Somewhere along the line, though, my perspective started to change. And I'll go through a bunch of things, but I'll talk about just one personal anecdote that happened just recently, which was that I had just broken up from a multi-year relationship. And, you know, as you are, you're usually depressed after these things. And I had a day where I'm sort of sitting at home feeling depressed, chatting with a bunch of friends online. And these are people I knew in real life, so it's not as though it was a bunch of strangers. It was a bunch of real friends who knew what I was going through, having conversations about it, not really feeling any better. That night, a friend comes over, and we spend about 45 minutes chatting in person, and I feel much, much better. 45 minutes of talking to someone face-to-face did what 10 hours of chatting online didn't do. Right? The topics didn't change. The person I was talking to was one of the people I was chatting with all day, but the medium changed. The way that we were communicating changed, and that made all the difference in the world. We know that there's a whole slew of issues with social media. People spend a lot of time trying to carefully curate their appearance to make themselves feel better so that they can get likes on what they post. It doesn't really work. It's a very short-term dopamine hit. We know that it makes everyone else feel bad because their own lives can't live up to this carefully curated appearance that they see. We're not really connecting with people on meaningful topics when we're doing this, so we're not really being vulnerable because we're not being authentic. We know that this creates all kinds of body image issues for all sorts of people, but especially young women. We see a lot of bullying, especially from anyone who's deviating from the mainstream culture in any way. And maybe we could live with this if social media, maybe we could mitigate this or live with this if social media was actually delivering the benefit of truly connecting us, but unfortunately it's not, right? So we're going through a lot of pain and we're not really getting the benefits that we had hoped for. So I don't believe that we can go backwards. I think we have to push forward, right? Never in the history of technology have we been able to go backwards. So we have to push forward and we have to figure out what does a post-social media world look like? What does it look like 10 years from now or 20 years from now? And I don't have the answer to that, but that's what we need to figure out.
Good afternoon, folks. As a product of this wonderful university, It's always a pleasure to come home. I think today in this session, literally, I'm under spotlight, so I have to make sure to behave, and that's going to be very difficult for me. And Ali is absolutely correct. We start with the youngest, and I guess we're finishing with the oldest person on the panel. Boy, I feel a lot of pain. Thanks a lot, Ali.
Wisest, you're the wisest.
Thank you. Now, I firmly believe, as someone who has been involved, you know, with a higher education for many years, I got my degree from CU just a few years ago. It's 1986, and I have been teaching in Vermont since then. And as an old professor, I teach both face-to-face and, yes, online courses. You can be old and use the technology in the classroom, too. I have to tell some of the young faculty that I recently hired. Those two are not mutually exclusive, by the way, you know. So sometimes they get a little bit cocky, and I got to remind them that I am the one that hired them. You know, they should be nice to me. Anyway, you know, and again, as a professor, as a teacher, as an educator, we must use all the available tools in our toolbox to help our student to learn and help their hardworking parents. But I think the question is what, you know, technology, social media, this thing has done wonder for my job. It made me a better researcher, made a lot of information available to me to conduct a meaningful research. As a graduate student here at CU in the 80s, I didn't have to spend a lot of time looking at do-it-this-mold, you know, and, you know, look for the data or for the source to conduct research. Also helped my student to learn better. It has helped our economy to become more efficient. It helped corporation, you know, to be more efficient, help people to find job. Also can be used to help our relationship, you know, with other people. But as I said, it can be a blessing, and these are examples of blessing, but also at the same time can be a curse. So we are in a love-hate relationship with a gadget like this. Now, recently, Wall Street Journal and NBC released a poll that 70% of us using this gadget think this gadget or, in general, social media are very divisive and causes mental and other problems for us as a user. But still, we are using it. We find it something very useful. That's the reason I'm saying we have a love-hate relationship. 3 billion people, 40% of the entire population in the world, including probably all of us in this room, you know, using a social media, and on average we are spending probably 2 hours a day, you know, using the social media. Now, the question is, same as food, same as, forgive me, alcohol, same as gambling, the question is moderation. How do we use food, alcohol? I don't know. The stuff in Vermont also is legal, smoking pot, you know. So all of this stuff. So I see similarity. There is a use and an abuse. And I think all of the good thing I said about the social media also exists. I can give you same example that causes a lot of problem is the fact our relationship with the loved one. You know, and I think one of the problems that I feel strongly we're facing with the social media, Facebook and other tech giants have been weaponized. As you know, some extremist group, subculture, using social media to spread the hate, misinformation. And I don't have to go that far to provide you with plenty of example. The recent example, what happened in Church Cross in New Zealand, what happened in Philippines, what happened in a lot of other countries. And I see some similarity between what has happened in those countries and genocides in Rwanda when people use radio as misinformation, as to send false information and hatred messages. And I think that's what I see as a challenge. And I'm a professor of economics. I don't really believe in government intervention, government regulation. But I think it's a reality, it's a fact that we have to face. That Facebook and other social media, they cannot regulate themselves. They cannot police themselves anymore because they don't have the business plan. You know, some young kids like Mark Zuckerberg, you know, created a platform that was wonderful. And I believe, and I totally believe, has done wonderful for all of us. But he could not imagine, he couldn't envision about all unintended consequences of a technology or the platform that he developed. I like the guy. He's an entrepreneur. But honest to God, I am sick and tired of seeing him, you know, going in front of a politician to regulator and said, we admit, and this is not by choice, it's by force. Tell us, keep telling us, I am sorry, we are sorry, we're going to correct the mistake. But the sad part is, they don't have the ability to correct their mistake. Their business plan need to change. And if they are not willing or do not have the ability to make changes and protect our privacy, to stop extremists, to spread the hate, then I hate to say it, somebody has to step in. And that might be a government to come up with a boundary, some rule and regulation. So I'm not going to blame the social media. I'm not going to blame the technology for unintended consequences. I think I use myself as an example. I'm the one probably need to change my behavior. It's not the problem with this gadget. Some of the problem is me, and I got to take some personal responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that this has introduced a lot of thought-provoking ideas, so continue to ask questions, either by flagging down someone with note cards or adding something to the app. And we're getting a lot of interesting questions already, and some of them relate to the very negative aspects of social media, some to the more positive. So I'm going to start on a more positive note, I've decided. And this has come up a couple of times from our panelists already. One of the benefits of social media is that companies like startups or artists, writers, can use it for promotion. So I'm curious what you all think about the benefits of social media for this, how you've seen this happen, and maybe where you might see this going even more in the future.
So I'm going to jump in anytime because you guys just got to pull me back here.
No, you're an expert. Go ahead.
there's a couple of thoughts here, right? In the corporate space, especially around digital and social media specifically. So the unifying factor of just digital in general is that for companies is that digital now and all of us. Before, companies could say anything they wanted, and they created a brand, and they created a brand promise that was maybe not all the times best represented by that brand, but it was what they wanted to be, right, not what they were. And what social's done is it's really required now that brands live up to the promise of what they propose, and we're all holding them accountable for that now. Okay, so that's the good news, and you know, frankly, what it's done for business, and I'll be a little provocative here with it's had the same like overall effect on business, in my opinion, as Title IX has for college athletics in terms of equality and bringing, letting an opportunity of a small school with 5,000 kids or 2,000 kids compete with the major universities that were the only ones competing for national championships before. Now it's created that equality, across the board, and equality for everybody to participate. And that's what, frankly, social and digital has done for business, giving one person, shops the ability to compete with the Pfizers and the whatever of the world, because you can do it genuinely and get your message out if it's a message that resonates in the market. And so those are tremendous opportunities. And the folks we're talking about, the businesses we're talking about, did not exist. I mean, Facebook was born in 2005. Twitter was born in 2006 as a company. The idea was around before that. But, I mean, 2006, that's 10 years old, right?
I'll keep that to me. Yeah.
I got belts older than that. How's that? I think it's tremendous for business and used in the right way. And what I'll say is that in business, morality has to take precedence when we get these new wild, wild west scenarios. And from my perspective, it's not the ability to have connectedness and to have platforms and all the wonderful things that come from Reza being able to connect with his, grandkids and cousins and everybody in Iran in real time. And that's fascinating, right? But we've got to have, at the business level, some responsibility. And frankly, the early stage of this, and we're in the very early stage of this, the business models to date have been broken, and that's a big part of the issues we're running into. The expectation that you can communicate globally on a scale that's unprecedented for free. Okay, let me put that in perspective. I just got mischarged for a murder, and my options are to pay for an attorney or to take the free one from the state provides. Who do you want? Who do you want? Okay? I just get diagnosed with an unforgiving disease, cancer. I can choose the best doctor that I can afford, or go to the free clinic. What do you want? Okay. So put that into perspective. Like, there's got to be a quid pro quo here. If I'm going to use your stuff for free, there's got to be an expectation that they're going to do something with that, right? And that's what we've been missing. But the premise of this and where it falls down is these business models are built on a dependency of data and attention. The longer they have your attention, the better their model, whatever their model is, works. And so the fact that Facebook has more psychologists on staff than any hospital or any, like, is amazing, right? And that's all to build attention, to consume more data from you. And that's what the breaking point of where we are, is that business model dependency.
If I may add, I believe, if I'm not wrong, one of the theme of this year's conference is empowering women. And I think social media has done a good job. I like to say great job, maybe I exaggerate a little bit, but I have done a good job helping business women. Because as we know, the wage disparity or inequality between men and women still exists. And there are not that many women, who are chief executive of a small or a large company. So I said glass ceiling is still there, but there are a lot of social networking that women, created, that they are supporting each other and providing a lot of valuable information that wasn't exist before. And I think that's one of the areas I give the social media a lot of credit, by empowering not only women, but some of the minorities, probably like myself, if I can put myself in that category.
Yeah, I'll just add, I would agree, like, as a as an independently published author, I'm completely dependent upon my reach on social media platforms to be able to reach people and let them know about my books. I'm dependent upon word of mouth. That's possible today in a way that just wasn't possible 20 years ago. So there's thousands and thousands of people who are making a living today as self-published authors that couldn't do it before, and in part it's about the technology to get books to people, but in part it's about being able to be seen. It's like I've been buying art from artists on Instagram, and that wasn't possible either in the past. So there's lots and lots of great things there. For me, where it falls apart is when big business gets involved, because suddenly their motives are not my motives. The artist who wants to sell art, like, their motives aren't really at odds with mine. Like, they just want to show me their art. If I like the art, great. If I don't like the art, I don't buy it. I look at another artist. When big business is involved, they want to influence my feed. They want to influence what articles are getting selected. They're putting the energy into search engine optimization. They're putting the energy into getting people out on all their social media platforms. Like, their influence is manipulative, and that's where I think social media starts to break down. And it also breaks down when when big companies are in control of the conduit. So a friend of mine, Amber Case, who's a cultural anthropologist that writes about this stuff, talks about the rise of the templated self. So in the early days of social media, when it was either like text-based Usenet groups or even in the age of blogging, you were completely in control of the platform. You wanted to write essays, you wrote essays. You wanted to write a paragraph, you wrote a paragraph. You wanted to post a picture, you posted a picture. These days, you don't have as much flexibility, right? If you want to participate in Instagram, it's an image-based thing. If you're photogenic, you're going to do better on Instagram than elsewhere, right? So you're sort of forced to fit the mold that's being created by these companies, and that creates also inherent biases.
So we are getting a lot of questions that are basically, what do we do about insert your favorite bad thing about social media? But one that's coming up frequently is addiction. And in particularly as it relates to questions like, should we be limiting screen time? Should we be worried about this, particularly with children who might be experiencing things like bullying online? So I'm curious what you think about the issue of addiction when it comes to social media, and maybe where you see this going in the future and what we can do about it.
I think I want to say few things about it as an educator. I think, you know, we got to start at early age by educating the children as how to use this gadget effectively. We do the same thing. We set a limit for our kids when it comes to a lot of things, playing a sport, you know, finishing your homework assignment, and a lot of other things. I want to use an example, you know, and I think I used it in another session yesterday. My friend's wife went to see the grandchildren from Vermont, went to Washington, D.C., and she purchased a book, and a storybook, I mean, a regular traditional old-fashioned book like this, and took it to Washington, D.C., give it to the grandson, well, I believe probably 2 or 3 years old. And she said, Reza, I couldn't believe it. I gave the book to my grandson, and my grandson picked it up and started doing this. So, I mean, you can't blame the young people because they haven't experienced something like this called the book. You open it and you read it. And I think we got to start at early age. And I got to give you this example. Some of the summer camp in Vermont are doing a good job by telling the parents, we're going to have a week or two summer camp for your sons and daughters, but they are not going to use this gadget for the entire time they are participating in that camp. We want to have a traditional, old-fashioned summer camp. So I think that, to me, I might be wrong, but to me, I think you got to start at early age, tell him this can be a blessing, this also can be a curse. I think we got to start there.
Thank you. I have twin 13-year-old boys. They are the only two kids, as far as I know, in their entire middle school that don't have smartphones. Now, I don't want them to be totally ostracized from their friends, so they actually have smartphones at home that just don't have SIM cards in them, so they can't use them as their daily phones. That means that they can get online for the duration of time I give them their game phone, so as they call it, and for the rest of the time they have feature phones, so they can text with their friends. So it's like they get to participate, but at a much more limited way than their other friends, who basically are inundated all the time. My daughter is 2 years older. She has a smartphone now. And she's appreciative of the fact that she went for a long time not having them when her friends all had them, because she was able to notice the difference between herself and her friends. And sometimes it just takes that little bit of time to notice that. I told a story in this morning's panel that was about how a while back I had this thing where every so often I would have this intense urge to buy a new car. And it would like overwhelm me, it would consume me, it would be all I would think about, and I would, you know, think about being very fiscally irresponsible to go buy a car I couldn't afford. And other times I was completely satisfied with the car that I had, and it took me a while to correlate these two things with the arrival of Car and Driver magazine in my doorstep once a month. Right? I was creating that for myself. But at that point in time, you could be outside the system. In other words, it could show up, I could get addicted to the cars, and then I could have that pass because I would then not have it being a constant feed all the time. It's very hard now with technology to walk away from your phone because it's always there. So how do you create those little absences? And I think that's a really important thing, whether that's taking a digital Sabbath, maybe you take a day off per week so that you're not using your phone, maybe you have a habit of nighttime comes and you just don't use your phone between 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock, whatever it is, but you have to give yourself some time away to be able to notice the effect that it has on you. If you don't ever get away, you can't notice the effect because it's so pervasive.
All right. I've been sitting on my hands here. and all absolutely. I mean, the key here is there's no wrong answer necessarily. Because let's face it, all of us are growing up in a world where we didn't have direction from our families, from our elders, on how do we handle this new device, this new thing we have access to. And as a natural result, a lot of us just jump in, right? And so, you know, we need a set of, you know, like intrinsic values and norms over a generation so that when our kids as kids start growing up, they'll have models and role models of what's a good use and what's a bad use and what's abuse and what's not. We simply don't have that right now, right? But there's intrinsic values that we all grow up with, and it's the reason we walk on sidewalks and drive on streets and not the other way around, because we've just grown up knowing that's the right thing to do. But then when there's horses and then carts and then combustible engines, like all that had to get figured out. So you know, don't get discouraged that we're all going to hell because of technology. We just got to figure this stuff out. And so a couple of things. Parents, you've got to recognize this is not just a kid thing. You have to take some ownership, as Reza said before, and some responsibility. Like, next time you go to a restaurant, look around you and see, count it, because it's going to be a lot easier, trust me. Count how many kids don't have a device in their hands at dinner, out to eat. Because it's so easy as a parent, and I've got three, right, to just bring the built-in babysitter and hand it off. And you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to talk to them. You don't have to, you know, like,
listen to them,
keep them from crying. It's awesome.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, as a result of us growing up in a world, and I say me, right, growing up in a world where I had to have conversations and I had to go to the playground and I had to deal with people, I had to look each other in the eye. I figured out a few things about social norms that I now believe in, right? And so kids growing up with a device don't have those same societal norms, which is not a bad thing necessarily. It's just different. And so we've got to, number one, not exacerbate the problem by creating an unintentional consequence of using the built-in babysitter, right? And then wondering at the age of 15 why my kid can't have a conversation with anybody that's longer than a sentence and actual verbal, right? Without staring at the ground or over their shoulder or something and never making eye contact. Like we can't look back and say, whoa, what the hell's the matter with my kid? Right? Well, they grew up with that intrinsic value, intrinsic set of values that they have. So what can we do? All right, a couple of key things, and number one, this every family has their own dynamics. Every family has their own intrinsic values that they instill in their kids. So this is by no means an all or none. But a few things, and you know, Will was absolutely dead on this. Like, govern the time. Right, just govern the time. And a lot of times, some key things that everybody has is dinner. Have family dinners when you can, and no devices, no TVs on, no nothing. And you know what? It's going to be uncomfortable for the first 2 weeks because you're going to have to reintroduce yourself to your kids and your family and your wife. But after that, you might have some interesting conversations and learn something about your family that you didn't realize. And cars. I see this all the time. Kids get in the cars and those wonderful backseat things, right, where they start the video up and they used to put the DVD in and now it's just automated. Stuff just appears out of nowhere. Like, turn that stuff off. Turn the radio down. No earbuds. Have a conversation. Where are we going? What are we doing? How was your day? How's school? How's your teacher? Like, there's all kinds of really fun, interesting things that have a societal benefit and a personal family benefit too, right? And so it's just reinstilling some of these things around analog opportunities, and then the other thing here is no devices in the bedroom. It's really easy to be the nice parent, the cool parent, because every other kid has it. It must be okay, right? Don't be a sheep. Make nothing in the bedroom. That is where kids, you know, they spend an inordinate amount of time. They're not getting sleep, which is what the bedroom's for, and that results then, if they're all tired, it results in a lower intellectual ability. It results in a direct relationship to mental health issues and a lot of downward spiral things from kids not getting sleep. When you go to a doctor, you're not feeling good, what's the first thing he recommends? Go home and get some rest.
If I may, I want to provide the audience with the data. And I told you guys, I'm literally under spotlight. I have to behave. I don't know if this is appropriate, but I'm going to say it because I think we're old enough. 10% of people younger than 25 years old respond to social media and text message during sex. That is the data to back up this argument.
I don't really want to go after that, but...
Speaking of...
No, I'm 30, thank you very much. But at the same time, I completely agree with setting barriers and time limits on social media. Back in the day, I remember having that with TV. But something that I've learned just personally with me and my husband is it would drive me crazy because he would be on his phone looking at Reddit all the time, which Reddit is a combination of a bunch of different news articles and things like that. It's basically, it sounds like a lot of what you were saying, Will, in terms of a community, the community back in the 80s, which it has some benefits. There are these niche groups groups that talk about a lot of the same issues that they're all similarly facing, and so benefit there that you can be heard by people that experience the same thing as you. But eventually what I started doing is I go, Chris, what are you reading? What are you looking at? And I think a lot of cat videos or whatever later, he started getting a little bit embarrassed and going, my goodness, maybe I should look at it something a little bit more stimulating. Mind you, he's very smart. I think he's a little superior intellectually sometimes. But I think by having that dialogue and saying, hey, what are you learning? What are you researching? What are you looking at? And then opening it that way too, it makes a nice conversation. And as Will said as well, those conversations are what binds us together. Together as a society, and I think we don't necessarily have to always be anti-social media. We just have to realize its place and then also use it for good and use it for conversations and use it for companionship.
I think that's about being intentional.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to watch cat videos because you're like, I need to decompress and I need 20 minutes of watching cat videos, like, go for it. But, like, you're intentional with your time, and you know that that doesn't mean that that's how you'll spend your whole evening. That's just, hey, I'm decompressing right now, and come get me in 20 minutes, right?
Exactly. It's on that news feed or whatever.
Yeah, and this is a new world, and kids are learning, they're growing, they're creating relationships, they're expanding their views, they're maturing online. Right, and it's not a bad thing necessarily, because my kids are so intellectually curious as a result of this that it's amazing. But at the same time, they can also, while being intellectually curious, type a couple of words that Google says they're looking for porn and turns them up in things that I don't want them to be, you know, like accessible at the age of 12, for instance. So I've set parameters on our technology, and so the point here is you've got to be curious enough. You know, back in the day, like I was IT for my household, but that entailed setting the clock on the VCR every time the power flickered and it went back to zero. My dad's like, "What the hell's wrong with it?" Right? Like that was the IT in my house at the time. Today, you can't have your kid in charge of your wireless devices, you know, the internet at the house and all the passwords and all that, and it's so easy again that as parents and elder statesmen, right, we have to be intellectually curious and at least have the conversation of, will this allow bad things to like come into our house, and how do we stop that? And have the conversation. It's okay to let them like set the boundaries, but at least know the passwords and have that curiosity and have those conversations with each other on what it is, and no matter what it is, just have conversations. Like little things, little cues we use for our kids in class. Like, so you just we make them take one side of an issue and look at each other, and then after they sit down, we ask them nothing about what they talked about. We ask them, what color was that person's eyes? Take that home tonight. Alright, ask your kid what color your eyes are. They won't have a freaking clue. Right? They're going to pull up your Insta and say, blue. But you get the point, right? And so there's these little cues that you can use to engage the right kind of responses that you're looking for.
So before we continue, I have a happy announcement, which is that apparently all 4:30 panels will be held as scheduled, and the jazz concert. I guess that means maybe the weather's letting up. I don't know. We don't know. We're here in this windowless room.
Okay, so
I'm gonna ask a question to start a question. People in the room, how many of you are active Facebook users? Like, actually use it, Facebook? All right. What about Snapchat? Okay, so for those of you who are watching on the live stream and can only see me, there is a clear generational difference here. As one of our questioners pointed out, I've heard that Facebook is for old people. This is true. And there are, and if you ask, you know, college-age students, you're mostly going to hear about Instagram and Snapchat. So some of the questions we've gotten are very directly related to the issue of the future of social media. Do we think that there are platforms that are popular right now that are going to stick around, that will still be here in 10 years? Or where do we see the future going? Like, what do we think our next generation of social media platforms that our five-year-olds of today are going to be using when they're in college?
As an economist, I forgot to bring my crystal ball with me, unfortunately. I left it in Vermont, so I let my colleagues draw it, and then I probably add up to what they want to say. Go ahead.
I truly hope we continue to evolve. This is a business, right? I mean, I don't want the same cars with the same safety features that we had in the 70s, right? I want new cars and modern safety conveniences. I don't want to go back to having, you know, like VHS tapes and that stuff, right? I want Netflix. So I hope we continue to change. But, the future, and this is going to take a lot of spin cycles for us, right? And today it's social media, and tomorrow in the very near future it's artificial intelligence. We're not going to be able to really necessarily tell what's real or what's not. And at some point somebody's going to take something I said here, voice over, and make it look like my lips are moving, and it's going to say that, something that's not what I intended, and that's all happening. It's all going to happen, but it'll create tremendous opportunities for people who can't hear or can't see or maybe an impairment or that AI offers or can't get places or whatever. So the incredible opportunities await, but virtual reality is going to change the game, and I think the curation of being the world's largest publishing platform like Facebook, right? I think that curation is going to change and start to involve things that will still allow you to be a little more intellectually curious, because I think today we get a lot of sameness as a result of all the algorithms and all the do good intentions of creating more attention and awareness and using getting more data out of us, but it's also stymied the exploration component that everybody kind of dug as we got into this, like finding new friends and new people and whatever, I hope anyway we see some of that diversity come back into these platforms.
I'm ready. I think my wife just texted me my crystal ball, so I'm ready. I'm ready to answer.
Yes.
And answer that question. I think the future for a social media platform is bright, if and only if they do not exclusively concentrate on entertainment. They should have another goal or objective. The role of a social media platform is supposed to be, according to my humble opinion, creating a medium that we can transfer knowledge, information from point A to point B. And I see it very clearly as a long-term educated. As I said, I teach face-to-face, I teach online, and I teach the hybrid, a combination of both. Now, I'm not anti-technology. I want to make that very clear. I think in some cases, not in all the courses, but in some cases, when we use exclusively technology that is very cost-effective for colleges and universities, and there are a lot of them that are like to get rid of the old expensive professor like me and substitute it with this gadget, I totally understand. just that. But we create efficiency. But I believe we lose effectiveness. And I want to give you a couple examples. I give a variety of examples. I give an essay exam. And when I read this, it's impossible to read a student writing. Ding, 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 ding. And when I read it, I say, my God, I didn't know I have international non-native speaker in my class. And I didn't know from being from Boston Garden, you know, qualify you as a non-native speaker. But another problem is when they come to my office, honestly, you know, you need to carry on a decent, effective conversation. There is no emotion. There is no change in voice. I know they're not from Italy like me with no hand motion, but you got to make an eye contact. You got to change your voice. And I think that's what we are missing, folks. That's what we're missing. So that's what I'm like to make very clear. Yes, we want entertainment, especially with young people. But we want to say there are other purposes for this gadget. Transferring knowledge, transferring information in the most cost-effective way. Thank you.
So if you had asked me before this panel what I thought the future of social media would be, I'd say I have no idea. But then thanks to the conversations we're having up here, I have an idea of a potential business opportunity should one of you have a skill set to do it. And I think it's based off of this conversation that we've had in terms of privacy and data. There might be a huge opportunity out there for someone to have a paid-for social media platform where you pay and in turn they don't sell your data to third parties. Parties and you aren't giving away all of your rights and things like that. And so I'm curious to see now, maybe 10, 15 years from now, if something like that becomes something that everyone raises their hands for, where they go, yes, I pay my $5 a month just like I do for Netflix, and in turn, I don't have to worry about these privacy concerns.
I'm glad you said that, this, because, you know, I'm from Vermont, and I tell my beloved Congressman Bernie Sanders, there is nothing free. Believe me, there is nothing free. So you pay either directly or indirectly using social media.
I think the data privacy and ownership is a super big issue. One of the places where I think we can take inspiration from is the sustainability movement. In the past, we had companies that were trying to move in the direction of sustainability, and there weren't really a set of standards for what that meant. And now we start to see some standards, like the certified B Corp, which is, you know, the intention is to certify a set of standards around sustainability that a company is adhering to. And I think we're going to see things like that from a data privacy perspective. It may not be legislated, but it's going to be a set of standards around data privacy and ownership and control that companies can opt into to give them a competitive advantage in the social media space. And that's going to be advantageous for those of us who want to use it and care about our privacy. And indeed, it may involve money moving around. I think a second area where we're going to see innovation is just to recognize that today software is built using fairly big building blocks. We're not really building lines of code anymore. We're plugging in things, and the barrier to building software and creating new social networks is dropping all of the time. And that means that you can have communities that aren't well served by the tools that are out there building their own social networks. So I think we're going to see more smaller networks by communities that aren't well served by the mainstream things that are out there. I'm also hoping we're going to see more real-world hybrids. So things that are going to get us together. Like Meetup is a great example of an application that's all about fostering real-world interactions. There are other ones that are trying to get started now that are about, you know, forming little salons in your home to have conversations about meaningful topics. Like those kinds of things, if we see more of that, that's going to be pretty amazing.
Okay, so we have about 10 minutes left, so what I suspect might be our last question I'm going to ask to everyone. So we've talked a lot about the pros and cons of social media. So in your mind, do you think that the benefits are outweighing the consequences right now? And if your answer is no, definitely not, then maybe, you know, what changes could happen, what tweaks could happen that might move us more towards benefits outweighing consequences?
As I said, I strongly believe that the social media, especially Facebook, has been weaponized. And as an immigrant, I'm a little bit nervous. I'm scared to see how the social media has been used lately to spread hatred. And I think I'm trying to be practical, realistic, and I'm the main beneficiary of it. So what I like to see, I like self-policing. I like those people come and tell the truth and tell us they want to clean their act. They really want to make the fundamental changes because they should know that the handwriting is on the wall. If they do not police themselves and correct all of these unintended consequences, I'm afraid the government is going to do it for them.
Yeah, so I'm not a big fan of government getting involved in how we should consume or not consume, right? I am a big advocate of education, though, and getting educated. Frankly, media in general has been spreading misinformation, At World War II, we were dropping pamphlets, in Europe, and it was our perspective, not the European perspective, right? This stuff's been around for a long time. Now, social media has a lot, is just the scale and reach and immediacy of it that wasn't there before. But this idea of spreading misinformation and having misinformation is not new, right? So it's not it's the size and immediacy that's the problem. So I don't want to paint Facebook in the picture that they're the problem for propaganda, because propaganda has been around for a long time. Now, they're the size and immediacy again. That's a different issue. They've got to start getting that right. But you know what? We don't have to look at it. So the point is I think that it by far the benefits have outweighed the negative aspects, and we're seeing a huge increase in issues around kids getting with bullying. It's just always on now. It's not that bullying's new, right? It's just that it happened at the playground for 10 minutes after school till you caught the bus and you went home and it was gone. Now you go home and kids have stuff in their bedrooms all night. It's 24/7. They can't get away from it. And that causes, a lot of mental, health issues. We got kids, predators who want to access, small and, and children. And this just provides them the avenue to do that in, right? That's scary stuff. Human trafficking is on a rise and all these things. But that's an education issue as much as anything. And we've got to start building some of these intrinsic values. I think we've lost, what we've lost is emotional intelligence. And what I think we need as part of social media and in this world of digital age is we need boredom.
I totally agree.
I want my kids to tell me they're bored. Right? And because I'll shut everything down in the first 10 minutes. Dad, I'm bored, I'm bored, I'm bored. And I got to listen to that. I'm like, oh, yeah. Right? But after 15 minutes, all of a sudden, the siblings are playing with it, figuring out how to play in a game because they know Dad's not giving in. And they're going to wear out before Dad does, right? That's a proven fact. So, I want my kids to be bored. And I want to be bored because that's when I start thinking differently. And, the best ideas come in the shower or whatever, right? That's not happens. That's like the alone time you have where you get to creatively think again. And so we need more boredom.
Do you want to go, Ernie?
I don't have an answer for social media, but I've also thought about the fact that people are spending an increasing amount of their lives around social media, and they're allowing social media to really to substitute for having a life.
To define them, yeah.
To define them.
Yeah.
And one of the other areas I'm also interested in is artificial intelligence and how I believe artificial intelligence is going to cause increasing amounts of unemployment in the future, which also raises questions about, you know, how do you define yourself if not by your career? What do you do with yourself when you're bored? And so I actually think that this is a bigger issue than just social media. It's about how do we find meaning, how do we find purpose, and if you have meaning and purpose, then things like social media aren't that big of a deal in the bigger scheme of things, because you still have something that's driving you. It's really just when you're struggling with that, that then these things can become overwhelming.
Just on a point to that now. So one of the things that we talk about is we ask kids all the time, right, across the country, like, what's important to you? And you get things like family and football and friends, right? And you get those kinds of responses. And I say, now show me your social media profile. And am I going to get family, friends, and football when out of your social media profile? Or am I going to get some other brand like Nike? Just do it. Right? Or hopefully not like KFC. What's that? Finger looking good? I hope that's not my brand, right? But so you put this into context and start thinking about what is your brand in these digital environments. You'll start to like think a little more critically about what the kind of information you're putting up, why you're putting it up, and what you want to do about it.
And I personally, I think it's a mixed bag too. I would not want to be a teenager growing up in this social media fueled society. I think it's hard enough to get to know who you are and find your passion without all of that. And then also, I think the other issue with social media oftentimes is it's all algorithm based. And so if you believe a certain thing and you're pretty entrenched in your opinions and you're looking it up, then there's that confirmation bias of we are targeting you with X thing, and then you're going to become even more and more entrenched, most likely, if you're only hearing that one side. And so I think that's where it gets tricky. But personally, for me, with starting my business, it's been an unbelievable resource, too, where having been on Instagram and found other people, say it's a urologist. This happened to me with Dr. Dana Rice. She started this UTI tracker app. I found her on social media. I found her on Instagram. I direct messaged her, and I said, hey, I'd love to have a urologist do some videos for me. And then that started a phone conversation, which started her doing 20-something videos on urology and adding a lot of legitimacy to my little brand. And so I think if you use it for good, it can be phenomenal. But at the same time, you need those parameters and you need those rules in order, especially when you're younger, to use it in the right way.
So, first of all, thank you to everyone who asked really great questions. If I didn't get to you, you are not alone. And there's like 50 more on the app. This is a really exciting topic. I hope that this gave you some things to think about. And now you can leave and go tweet about it. So that's what I recommend. Thank you again to our panelists, to the audience.